Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we begin a Brian Lehrer Show series. How well did democracy work this presidential election cycle? Between now and Inauguration Day, we're going to take some time to debrief the presidential election process, digging in on some of the areas where there's a lot of heat around the question of whether there's a better way to go about it. And we'll start today with the Electoral College. Now, normally it's a mental footnote, but for the second time this century, the winner of the popular vote, as you know, did not get to gain the presidency. And the petitions asking the electors in states Trump won to vote for Clinton abound. Even Donald Trump thinks the Electoral College is a bad idea.
I would rather see it where you went with simple votes. You know, you get 100 million votes and somebody else gets 90 million votes and you win.
Trump on 60 Minutes to explore how we got it and the consequences of having gotten it. I'm joined by Andrew Rudalevich. He is professor of government at Bowdoin College and contributor to the Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog. Welcome to WNYC, Professor.
Thanks, Brian. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start at the beginning, because I think a lot of people upset about the Electoral College right now are confused about how it got into the Constitution to start with. It seems, in a way, counterintuitive, to the concept of democracy where everybody gets a vote.
Well, it's important to remember that the Constitution is not built around majoritarian democracy. And let me work my way back to that point. To start with, the Constitution, you know, doesn't come down from on high. It's not delivered on tablets from Mount Washington. You know, this is a bunch of political actors trying to figure out how to, on the one hand, build a strong central government, or at least a stronger central government, but also to get a document that can be accepted, you know, by the wider political actors of their day. So they've got to come up with something that can get ratified effectively. And the Electoral College turns out to be a pretty important compromise towards that end. You know, there were some people who wanted Congress to pick the president. There were some people who wanted popular elections. And in the end, they effectively compromised. They sort of moved a little bit towards unbalanced mode of election, as to say smaller states wound up with a little more oomph than they would have had under a directly proportional system. But they came up with this idea of sort of separating it both from the public as a whole, but also from Congress. And so it's a compromise, but not a random compromise. It does fit into the broader scheme of the Constitution.
The number of electors a state has is equal to the number of senators plus representatives. And that advantages low population states a little bit because they automatically get three votes no matter how few people live there, because every state has two senators.
Right. So you've got, what, 500,000 people in Wyoming, say, compared to, you know, 38 million people in California, because both of them have senators and the same number of senators. You wind up with every voter in Wyoming having, you know, 2.5 to 3 times the amount of weight towards each elector, you know, in that state. And so, you know, the biggest problem with the Electoral College is that it is not a representation of one person, one vote, right? Some voters are more equal than others.
One meme going around is that it came into existence to protect slavery. To what extent is that true?
I think that's simplified. You know, it's pretty hard to separate out the role of slavery from any part of American history. But, you know, the Electoral College was not a direct result of that debate, except insofar as it does flow from the broader compromise to create Congress in the first place, right, to actually create equal representation in one body of Congress, the Senate. Once they had agreed to that great compromise, and, of course, that's built on what you might think of as a not-so-great compromise to count slaves as 3/5 of a person for representation purposes in the House, you know, then, you know, smaller states and slave states, and those actually, you know, were not entirely the same thing. You had small northern states who were also very interested in avoiding pure popular choice for the presidency. But that does create a sort of alliance, right? The smaller states want to make sure that they're not going to get rolled by the larger states. So from their point of view, the perfect solution would, in fact, be selection by Congress, because that's where they have the strongest representation. So the larger states manage to move it away a little bit from that. But they, of course, do in the end protect the smaller states from, you know, this notion of a geographically concentrated majority.
Democrats right now, of course, are very upset about the Electoral College after Bush versus Gore in 2000 and now this election. And in the 19th century, there were three elections where the popular vote winner lost in the Electoral College. Were there calls to get rid of it then?
Well, I mean, a lot of these, I mean, it should be noted that the popular vote and the Electoral College have tracked most of the time. You know, in the 19th century, 1824, you know, has something of an asterisk because many states at that time did not use the popular vote to select their electors at all. It was done by state legislatures. So after sort of Jacksonian democratization of the selection process, you've got 1876, which is an extraordinarily corrupt election, and it's not clear exactly who won. You know, that's an example where the Democratic candidate got more than 50% of the popular vote but loses the Electoral College by one vote. But it's, you know, that's an election where the popular vote is disputed, and, of course, a commission is set up to award the electoral votes of all the disputed states, and it just so happens that a Republican majority commission awards every single disputed vote to the Republican candidate. So it's a little bit hard to say that that's a, you know, that's the fault of something, but is it the Electoral College? 1888 is a pretty clear example, though the winning margin was less than 100,000 votes in the popular side of things. And then we come, of course, to 2000 and 2016. There really has not been any sustained effort. There was a vote in the House, I think, in the late 1960s that succeeded in winning the two-thirds you need to move a constitutional amendment forward, but that didn't go anywhere in the Senate. Not surprisingly, smaller states, who again are overrepresented in the Senate, have very little interest in moving this forward. So, you know, one of my colleagues, Julia Azari, over at Marquette University said, you know, if the losing side in these cases had enough political clout to change the Electoral College, they probably would have won the election in the first place, and they would have been perfectly happy with the status quo. And I think she has a point, right? This is a pretty high bar to amend the Constitution, which is why you have other options being proposed, and we can, you know, certainly talk about the National Popular Vote Compact and efforts like that if you'd like.
And we will do that. And listeners, you're invited to call in on the Electoral College. For Professor of Government Andrew Rudalevich from Bowdoin College, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And just before we get into some of the things that are going around in petitions now, like the National Popular Vote Compact and some other things, how different do you think campaigning would be if we did away with the Electoral College? We in New York or New Jersey or Connecticut, which were all, you know, obviously Democratic voting states and really didn't see any campaign appearances, might see the candidates at free events instead of fundraisers in the ballrooms of Manhattan? Or how much do you think would actually change?
Well, I mean, that's one of the questions, right? When you change the rules of the game, you change the way in which campaigns work. So it's always hard to go back and say counterfactually, well, if only we hadn't had the Electoral College, X would have happened. Presumably both candidates would have run somewhat different campaigns. You know, it will depend, I think, on how much up for grabs different you know, regions of the country seem to be. You know, New York's a pretty safe Democratic state. California, of course, where a huge amount of the popular vote margin is going to come out of. Likewise, so there would be incentive to, you know, extract every vote, right? If you were the campaigns, you would want to make sure that you're, you know, turning out your vote in places that are, you know, favorable to you. That doesn't necessarily mean there'd be a huge amount more of public campaigning. You know, it would depend. I mean, the idea, of course, is that you wouldn't have swing states in quite the same way. You wouldn't see, you know, the exaggerated attention that states like Florida and Pennsylvania and so forth got this year. So there are, you know, there would certainly be shifts in the campaign. It's a little hard to predict what those would be. And certainly, you know, if you are in, you know, the large landmass in the middle of this country, you're worried about that because you figure, well, why would, you know, Donald Trump came up for the second district in northern Maine. You know, several times. That it's hard to imagine he would have done that under this other system.
Janet in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janet.
Hello. I was under the impression that the Electoral College was set up in order to in case there was a bad popular vote, they felt that they could overturn a bad popular vote.
Bad popular vote meaning what?
That maybe they thought the wrong candidate was elected. So now they could, you know, after the election, they could put in the better candidate.
Would you be happy with a system like that, Janet, if it
no,
really
I
was
that? No, I want to get rid of it. But I'm thinking about in the past when it was set up.
Professor was
frankly
say it again. You wish they would do away with it. Frankly,
I wish they could do it now. Just say
right away between now and December 19th. Janet, thank you very much. Did that have anything to do with it? Was there a kind of, because I think what she's describing is a sort of elitist, and I don't even mean that as an insult. Impulse that, God, sometimes, you know, the mob in democracy, the people, can make a really horrible choice for the country, and somebody's got to be a firewall there.
Right. Well, again, you know, where we started off our conversation was thinking about the Constitution as setting up a republic, a representative democracy, not a direct democracy. And there's various features in our national government and our balance of power between the branches and between the states and the federal government that underlay that and reinforce it. And the Electoral College was indeed set up to be sort of free of demagoguery. You know, that's one reason that all the electors vote in their separate states. You didn't have them all together, and therefore a very convincing demagogue couldn't come along and corrupt them or sway them with his silver tongue all at once. The idea, certainly, at least the delegates hoped it would be the case, that this would be an independent body of smart people who, most importantly, had the knowledge of the national political leadership and would be able to judge between them. One reason that people were worried about the popular vote was not so much that people were stupid, but that they didn't necessarily have information. You know, you didn't have widespread public education. You didn't have even universal literacy, certainly. And so to know who the plausible candidates were across the country, you know, the framers saw that really as an elitist question in some ways. You know, and they left the choice of who would do the choosing up to the states themselves. The thing is that, you know, the idea of coordinating, you know, across 13 at that time states, you know, this is why the political party system began to exist in part at the national level, was to be able to make sure that you wound up with a choice in the Electoral College and that you didn't splinter your vote. Electors, nonetheless, remain independent, even today. And there is a question about the so-called faithless elector,
right?
Some people, including, it sounds like, the caller, are kind of rooting for a whole bunch of faithless electors. But electors these days are not chosen on the basis of their independent judgment or information. They're chosen basically as a slate. You know, they don't even appear as names on the ballot in lots of states, and they are chosen for the exact opposite of their independent judgment. They are supposed to vote for the party, and that is why I think it will be pretty difficult to convince Republican electors to change their vote in this case.
I think we have a caller who has signed a faithless electors petition, if I'm not mistaken. Ken in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ken.
Hey there. So Daniel Brizenoff of Long Beach started that petition on change.org for the Electoral College to vote for Hillary Clinton since she's gotten the, you know, the popular vote. And that petition is up to 4.5 million supporters, and it continues to grow. My question is, how can this impressive petition help electorates work up the courage to go from moving in a very, very ceremonious way to then doing what is right for the country, and that's keeping the power of voting for the president out of the hands of the uninformed? What does that process look like?
Now, do you really want to go there, Ken? That might work to, you know, better the country in this case, in your view, but what about some other time when the electors might look at a candidate who you support and say, gosh, the people were just too ignorant? Do you really want to put that power in the hands of a few elites?
You know, the I think this is a very, very unique time in the history of our country. And you have an individual who is a reality TV person who has used this inflammatory language, I mean, and has committed so many offenses, you know, the countless, you know, all the way to this past weekend with, you know, with Hamilton and everything, you know, that cast and whatnot. But yes, I guess the answer to your question is, I think it's time to dust off the this, you know, it's a very, very ceremonious kind of action that happens every 4 years. And I guess I would be willing to see exactly what would happen, because I just don't think that Donald Trump is the right person with all the issues and mm-hmm. with TPP and our all our issues abroad. And then we're imploding as a country, you know, right now with, I mean, he's just not the right leader with the right temperament. And he's been given
just
a pass
too
on everything.
Too dangerous. I mean, it's got to be a really high bar. Right. It can't be you disagree with him on TPP or you don't like his inflammatory language, but you must see him as really, really dangerous to want the system of electors to actually overturn the people's will after they heard all his. How many people didn't see his, you know, his racist comments and his sexist comments and his about the disabled person, and they decided anyway, enough of them in the states with the electoral votes to vote for him, right?
That is the sad part, is that we have he has 60, you know, approximately 61 million people who decided to give him a pass on everything that he has done, you know, instead of voting for someone who just has some discrepancies regarding her email.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it. So Ken represents the Faithless Electors petition and the 4.5 million people or however many it is at this point who've signed that. Is there any way to get a head count, Professor? Or is there any, I mean, I presume the, you know, the chances of it actually swaying enough electors to swing the election is approximately zero as a matter of political analysis. But what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, it's I think I agree with your math. The chances are small. Again, these electors are chosen on the basis of their partisan loyalties, and what we saw in the election was that party loyalties are extraordinarily strong, right? I think most pundits expected that, you know, that Mr. Trump's wilder statements would drive a lot of people away. And if you look at the exit polls, it looks like, you know, he basically replicated a lot of the Romney coalition, right? He lost the female vote, but not by as much as, you know, some might think he should have. He lost the Latino vote, but ditto. Right. And in the end, Mrs. Clinton is going to wind up with, you know, there's some questions about the exit polling there, but certainly, you know, Mrs. Clinton is going to wind up with 3 million votes fewer or so than President Obama did when he won in 2012, while, you know, again, Mr. Trump is going to wind up with about the same, maybe a few more votes than Mr. Romney did. So we wind up with, you know, there are lots of questions here. And of course, you know, one of the great issues of studying American political institutions is that, you know, there's a lot of situational ethics that go on. We see this in issues of presidential power. We see it in the Electoral College. I'm pretty sure that most Trump supporters, if the shoe were on the other foot, would be making these same phone calls about how illegitimate the Electoral College is. And so, you know, it does quite often depend on the eye of the beholder as to how you evaluate the arguments for institutional change. I guess I would say that, you know, there are problems with the current system, but there are also conceivably, you know, unintended consequences of shifting that system. One option, of course, is that the parties wind up appealing to wider parts of the population, and the electoral vote and the popular vote realign, as they've done for most of American history. It's possible, though, that we'll see a an increasing shift, right? If people are more geographically segregated by party and concentrated, you know, urban voters supporting the Democrats, rural voters supporting Republicans, we might see this happen more often, and that will probably boost the conversation about reform.
Manolis in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Manolis.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. My question relates to proportional representation of the electors in each state. So I find that I understand the reasons why there's some there are electors for each state starting from three. But it makes no sense to me at all that if the candidate get one candidate gets 51% of the votes in the state, takes all the electors. And I was wondering if anyone has done the math, or at least for the 2000 and 2016 elections, to see if we had a proportional representation for electors, what would the overall result be for the presidency?
People have done that math. I don't know if they've done it for 2016 yet, because we're still waiting on final numbers. But there's a couple things tied up in there. I don't know if the caller's still on the line.
Yes.
But there are. Yeah, so are you talking about assigning the electoral votes exactly proportionally, i.e., you know, dividing them up by tenths of a vote or something like that? Or are you talking about the congressional district system that Maine and Nebraska have, or either?
So I was talking about the former. For example, if Clinton gets 65% of the votes in New York State, she gets 65% of the electors in New York State.
Yeah, people have talked about that. It's been that would require a constitutional amendment, most likely, though you could perhaps, you know, it's hard to know how to divide up a person, right? And the Electoral College is made up of individual people at the moment. It's not clear they can cast a fraction of the vote. But if you did change it, and I should point out, by the way, that you don't need a majority of the vote to win the electoral votes of a state. You only need a plurality. And, you know, when you have a splintered system with three or four or five candidates, that might mean you get far fewer than 50%. What that tends to mean then is that, you know, because you have maybe a candidate getting 40% in each state, you wind up with an enhanced likelihood that nobody gets a majority in the Electoral College. And so that's something to keep in mind, too.
But you said...
I did actually...
Sure.
So just to go back to the math part, under a proportional system, you know, I'm just glancing at notes here that suggest that 1960, 1968, 1992, and 1996 would not have given us a majority in the Electoral College. So they would have gone to Congress under the current system, which I suspect is...
Right.
Not
so
what
that
reformers want.
So that reform might have to include plurality wins as one of the options, or it could include that. But you said it would take a constitutional amendment to go to that kind of proportional electoral vote designation system. Apparently, it wouldn't take a constitutional amendment to go to a system where they're allocated by congressional districts, which isn't exactly the same thing, but it starts to approach it. So like they do have in Maine and Nebraska, as you pointed out, and Donald Trump was, you know, counting on that one particular more Republican-leaning district in Maine to possibly give him one electoral vote, even if the rest of the state went for Clinton. Every state could do that, and you wouldn't need a constitutional amendment, but it would be a state-by-state basis?
Yeah, I think I suspect that at least as the parties are currently distributed, that would wind up with an outcome that more or less mirrored what we have now. Keep in mind that congressional districts are pretty creatively gerrymandered right now to make them relatively uncompetitive. It's not so much of a big deal in Maine because we've only got two congressional districts up here, and you kind of figure out where half the population is, which is clustered in the south of the state. And, you know, the northern district is actually 80% of the landmass of Maine. But, you know, that's not so much of a big deal. But if you go to Pennsylvania or Florida, you know, places where there are numerous congressional districts and they have been drawn to favor one political party or another, you know, you're going to wind up more or less replicating the House.
That's right.
In your Electoral College votes. And
which
of course
can be
not
gerrymandered. And there have been a number of elections recently where Democrats won the national popular vote for House of Representatives, if you add up all the votes in all the House districts. But the Republicans still came out with a clear majority of seats because of the ways the districts have been drawn, which are up to the state legislatures in the 50 states. And if Republicans win more state legislature seats, then they have the power to do that. And that's the gerrymandering issue, which we will take up separately later in this series, about how democracy actually worked during the presidential election process. But before we run out of time, I want you to explain the National Popular Vote Compact. I had a call from somebody last night who said that he signed at home, who said he signed the National Popular Vote Compact, and we should really talk about this because this is the way to the future to disable the excesses of the Electoral College. What is the National Popular Vote Compact?
Well, this is a compact between states, and it takes advantage of the fact that the states do have free rein in how their electors are chosen. And basically what it says is a state will pass a law saying that if enough other states, adding up to 270, a majority of electoral votes, decide to sign on as well, they will commit to picking electors who are supposed to then vote for the winner of the national popular vote and not for the winner of the popular vote in their state. And so if that worked, you would have, if you had a case where, the Republican Party won the plurality of the national vote, voters in California who might have gone Democratic would nonetheless be committed to voting for the winner of the national popular vote.
And it's been enacted, I see, into law in 11 states with a total of 165 electoral votes. So that's a meaningful start. California, D.C., Hawaii, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Vermont, and the state of Washington. And
right.
It would take
all
effect.
Democratic states, if you look at that.
And it would take effect when enacted by states with 105 more electoral votes and has passed one house or the other in 12 states with 96 electoral votes. I know that's getting complicated, but those 12 states where one house of their legislature has passed it are more politically mixed: Arizona, Arkansas, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Michigan, North Carolina, New Mexico, Nevada, Oklahoma even, and Oregon. So how likely is it that if they did manage to get the 165 votes lined up, it would face a constitutional challenge?
Well, I think it is constitutional because, it's tied to the way in which the states select their electors. They can pass a law in the state saying that every elector shall vote for a certain candidate, right? Not necessarily a personal candidate, but the winner of the national popular vote. So I think it might face constitutional challenges, but I think it would probably withstand them. I think the issues there are a little trickier down the road in that, would we have, we talked about faithless electors earlier. Would we have a resurgence of those? Would those California electors really vote for the Republican candidate? Or would, electors in Oklahoma really vote for the Democrat? That's an issue partly because it's hard to know whether or not the state law that would require electors to vote in a certain way could be enforced. Right? The Supreme Court has ruled that such a law is constitutional, but nobody has ever enforced it, and it's not clear whether it could withstand a constitutional challenge as to the enforcement because there's nothing in the Constitution binding the electors. Could the states override that? I'm doubtful. The other issue, of course, is that if you go to a direct national popular vote system, you do raise these other questions of splintering the two-party system. And some people will say, yeah, that's great. We should do that. Others are more concerned about the lack of stability that might bring if you did have a multiple candidate field and somebody winning with 20 or 22 or 25% of the national vote. That could be, fixed if you talk about a runoff election or you talk about some kind of threshold or you talk about something like ranked choice voting. But I don't think that's currently, in the plans for the National Popular Vote Compact. And so I do think there are other questions that people have raised. You could wind up with sort of the majority choice, coming in second, third, or fourth, in the popular vote if it were split in different ways. And so, I think that it's a question of risks and rewards as we think about institutional reform.
Well, we'll see how close they get to the total states needed to actually get to 270 electoral votes represented for that to even take effect. But the National Popular Vote Compact petitions are out there. The Faithless Electors petitions are out there. And now, folks, you know a little more, hopefully, than you did a half hour ago about the Electoral College. We thank Andrew Rudalevich, professor of government at Bowdoin College and contributor to the Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog. Thank you so much.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute.